Hey, movie retrospective time.
Yeah.
Finally getting around to doing this classic movie. Sorry about this, but it kept getting like pushed back on the schedule. But I finally like said, well, I have to do it this month because one of our listeners, Dominic, sent me the Blu-ray.
Yeah, it's like a deluxe Blu-ray.
Has all the extras and stuff on there. Yeah, so it's really, really cool. And this is like probably one of my favorite horror movies from the 80s. I mean, because I'm a huge Clive Barker fan. This is, of course, Hellraiser. Now, this came out in 1987. There had been a few, I mean, Clive Barker, it's very funny, like, watching the documentaries. There's actually a really good, it's a two-part documentary called Leviathan, about the making of Hellraiser and Hellbound Hellraiser 2. And it's about, I think each one is like an hour and a half long. And it's on the Blu-ray. It's also on Shudder, if you have that. So both parts are up there if you want to watch them. But it's just like funny watching the documentaries and like watching all the fucking, you know, seeing all the photos like from the, you know, the filming of this, because Clive Barker looked like a fucking kid. He was like so fucking young. You know what I mean? So I feel like, you know, he was known as a writer, but, you know, a few of his things had been adapted to the screen, but he wasn't really happy with how they turned out. I mean, because if you've read any of Clive Barker's stuff, and even subsequently, like, it doesn't translate. A lot of it doesn't translate that well to the scene. It's, like, not as to the screen. It's, like, not as cool as...
Yeah, didn't Clive Barker have something to do with the story behind Rawhead Rex?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Rawhead Rex, we liked it at the time, but you watch it now and you fucking, you know, it's just silly as shit.
Yeah,
you know,
it was a terrible movie.
Terrible movie, but at the time there was something about it. You could get away with a lot more back in those days.
You could, yeah.
We were just hungry for more horror movies to watch.
Yeah.
To rent at fucking Blockbuster. That's really what it was. That's it. And when I saw that fucking demon come, or that fucking medieval demon with that head piss on that priest, he goes, and he's going, baptize me. That sold the whole fucking movie for me and all my buddies. For me and all my buddies were like, this shit's epic. And that's really all we remember to that. And a damn, and in an Irish church, there was a stained glass window with a fucking devil in it.
Yeah.
And that nobody thought that was strange in the church.
Yeah, in you the town. I mean? It's like, that seems a little suspicious.
Yeah. We were looking and going, oh man, it's cool. Yeah. I want that for my room. You know, that kind of shit.
I would still like that for me.
Yeah. I want that window in my room. Yeah.
Now that you mention it, I feel like Rawhead Rex, that really needs a remake, because I feel like that's such a cool idea for a story.
Yeah.
If it could be done correctly, like without that goofy looking demon with like the weird googly eyes or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good concept. It's just, and I think that happened with a lot of Clive Barker stuff. That a lot of his ideas are really good and like his books are really good, but it's like when they try to execute it, and it's not like for the same reason that Stephen King stuff,
right,
for a while didn't work on screen. I mean, I think that's kind of like gone by the wayside now because there've been so many like,
you know,
good
adaptations. What's funny is that we love that fucking Rawhead Rex monster. Our standards were so much lower back then.
Well, yeah.
Pumpkinhead kind of ruined it.
Well, Pumpkinhead was
so much better.
Awesome. We need to do that movie.
Yeah.
Too.
Now, you know what I mean? Shit, but we kind of thought Rawhead Rex kind of looked kind of cool, but we expected things to look fake.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you had a different frame of reference.
It's a different frame of reference.
Now, I should say though that so Hellraiser, you know, Clive Barker, he'd had a few like adaptations of his stuff done and he really wasn't happy with it. So he's like, well, I want to direct, you know, my own movie. Now, he didn't really have any experience, like, doing that. He said he famously, like, showed up on the set, and he's like, at least, like, everybody in the crew and shit like that were, like, patient, because he's like, I didn't know one lens from another, and I didn't really know what I was doing. That said, though, I mean, I think this is probably easily the best Clive Barker adaptation. This and Candyman, which we've already reviewed. I've heard Midnight Meat Train is good too, but I haven't seen that one yet. Like, I feel like that's got kind of mixed reviews.
I'd have to say visually though, and just the way it's shot, and I would have to say Candyman is better. But in terms of, you know what I mean, the way it was shot and the way it was made, the quality, I think it looked more stylish.
Yeah.
This is a good movie of its type though. You know what I mean? Hellraiser.
Yeah.
It's not bad. I'm just saying, I think Candyman was a little bit better in the way it looked. That's just by memory.
It was a different, you know? Yeah, it was directed by someone else. So it was like a different, you know, they had a different like approach to it.
Had the colors a little bit better and the shot compositions and everything. I remember them looking really good.
Yeah, because they had like those high up, like those drone shots and stuff. Well, it wasn't a drone shot back then. It was a crane shot.
Probably a helicopter.
Or a crane.
Yeah. This one, it gets the job done. Hellraiser got the job done. It wasn't super artistic the way it was, but I guess it was. It's just not to the same extent.
Yeah, I mean, I think the what this movie ended up doing, I mean, you have to imagine this came out in 1987. Now, horror movies were very much in the forefront. There were a lot of really popular ones that had come out like that year and a couple years prior. But it seemed like a lot of the kind of, you know, horror movies that people remembered or ones that were doing really well at the box office were kind of funny. You know what I mean? Like, you had like a lot, there was like a lot of humor and a lot of kind of over the top gore and stuff.
That's what I like.
So and I like that too, but I feel like the cool thing about Hellraiser was that it was a very serious horror movie when no one was really doing that.
Yeah.
And it was also, you know, now it, looking back on it, because we've seen pretty much everything in horror movies nowadays, but in 1987, this was like a really original vision. I mean, nobody had made a movie that looked like that, that made like, that had the villains that looked like that, like the Cenobites. I mean, it was just, and even like the whole story of it, of like this really weird, and like a lot of the people on the crew said this too. It's like, essentially, this is a fucked up love story, because what, you know, the main character of Julia, she's essentially, she's trying to kill people to put flesh back on her fuck buddy.
Yeah.
Because she is so
husband's brother.
Yeah, who was, because she was like her so obsessed with him. Like, she had this crazy, like, weird, fucked up, obsessive love with him that she is willing to kill random dudes or even like her own family members to put flesh back on him so she can get the D once again.
I hadn't seen this one in a long, long time. I'd even kind of forgotten what year it came out in. You know what I mean? When you said 87, I remember when we were watching it, I was like, no way. It couldn't have been that.
Yeah, late. He argued with me. I thought, it was 87.
I thought I saw it when I was in high school, but I actually saw it when I got out of high school, left Brazil and went back to the United States. I was living in Michigan and was hanging out with my friends for the summer before they went off to college. This is before I joined the Army. And that's when we saw it. We rented it. We were playing Master Blaster and shit on NES and all that kind of crap, you know? And, watching it again, it's still a good movie, but a lot of the impact this movie made had a lot to do with the timing of this movie.
Yeah.
When it came out, it was doing stuff, it was kind of revolutionary in a way. It was very story heavy. And like you said, it had kind of a serious tone to it. I remembered watching it back then, thinking that the only thing that it reminded me of was it kind of reminded me of Videodrome.
Yeah.
In those days.
I can see that.
But looking at it now, it's kind of slow paced by today's standards. And I remember really being intrigued by these Cenobites. I was like, man, because they didn't really tell you much about them.
Yeah.
They just appeared. They didn't get a lot of screen time. They had a very ominous appearance to them, and that was kind of like the beginning of that kind of gothic industrial cyber look that started to come in the goth scene a couple years later. You know what I mean? I think that kind of the way they were dressed kind of helped that look that ended up becoming what you saw in the Matrix in a way.
Yeah,
long black stuff and, you know, black shiny type shit, and it kind of had a BDSM vibe to it. But it was just a weird movie to see, you know, back then.
That's what I mean. It really kind of came out and blew the doors off. And like I said, not only because it was like a serious toned horror movie that was essentially a domestic drama with sadomasochism and gore. I mean, you hadn't really seen anything like that or anything like that done in a way that was like being serious, that wasn't like kind of over the top or stupid or silly or done for laughs. So from that point of view, it's like really hard to overstate how revolutionary it was at the time, because really nobody had seen anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, going back in time, me and my buddy Steve and Jason, when we were watching it, we kind of put this in the same group as like From Beyond and Reanimator, but more serious. We kind of thought it was a little bit like something like From Beyond, but and Videodrome. We liked it. It was pretty good. But you know what's funny is that I remember when we saw it, afterwards we'd be asking a bunch of questions about these Cenobites. And we mostly focused on that.
Yeah.
Because it didn't quite give you enough. And then I remember part two came out, and that was pretty good.
I actually quite like Hellraiser 2, yeah.
But then I remember, like, 3 came out. I don't remember anything about 3. I just remember, like, it started to fall apart for me.
Yeah, I think after 3, I stopped watching them. I didn't even realize that there have been 10 of these movies. So there were 9 sequels to the first one.
I didn't realize it.
Doug Bradley, the guy that famously played Pinhead, who wasn't called Pinhead in the first movie, he was just called Lead Cenobite. You know, he got called Pinhead by the fans, and then the name stuck.
Right.
But so that wasn't a Clive Barker invention. But he was in, I think, up until the 7th or 8th one, and then they had to get somebody else. But the funny thing about this movie, this is kind of the thing that happens with all these types of things. Like I said, I remember reading a lot of Clive Barker's stuff when I was a kid, and that's kind of what made me. I mean, I'd read Stephen King and, you know, a lot of the classics and stuff, but his writing was what made me want to be a writer, because like his imagination is just fucking crazy. And it's just like fucking the shit he comes up with in his stories. I had never read anything like that before. And it's like, you know, not only can he fucking write, he also is like an amazing artist and he can do all this other shit. So he's kind of like this Renaissance man. And he was, so he had been working with this theater group, and he wrote the novella that Hellraiser was based on, which is called The Hellbound Heart, which is actually pretty good, and it's very similar to the movie. I think he actually wrote it with the intention of turning it into a film, which is why there's not that much difference. So he was kind of trying to shop it around. Eventually, because he wanted to direct it, because like I said, you know, they had been doing some, you know, adaptations of his stuff, and he didn't really like the way they were coming out, so he wanted to do something of his own vision. So they were able to get, I think at first they were going to get like, remember Richard Branson? They did Virgin Films for a while. They were like funding some movies.
Yeah, I remember that.
Now they initially said he was going to put up the money to do it. And then that kind of fell through and they decided they weren't going to do movies. So I think they got New World Pictures, amazingly. And I had forgotten about this and I was watching the movie again and like, you know, checking out how fucking badass the special effects are still. This movie costs less than $1 million.
You never know by looking at it.
You would never know. I mean, some of the effects, like near the end, you know, especially the thing like with the dragon creature and the fire and everything, that looks a little hokey, but that was just because that was kind of like tacked on at the end and the, like they didn't really have a lot of time to do it. But especially, I mean, the whole set piece of, I mean, I was watching it again the other night and I hadn't seen it for like a few years. The whole part where, you know, the blood drips on the attic floor and Frank, you know, skinless Frank starts emerging out of the floor. I was like, holy shit. I forgot how fucking good that looks.
Yeah.
And like, it's like, you know, his little brain is there on the floor and it's like going like veins crawling. And it's like this little spine goes into it and all chunk and everything. And then like the whole shit with like him slowly, like as Julia starts like picking up randos at bars and like slaughtering them in the attics for him to feed on and get his skin back. And just the whole, like, you know, the whole process of him getting the skin put back on, it's just, it looks fucking great. It really does. I mean, still nowadays. Now, the same guy that played Frank in human form, like in the flashbacks and stuff, that is not the same guy that played skinless Frank because they needed a super, super skinny guy. So that's one thing that I thought was really weird, and I had forgotten about this until I was rewatching it, is a lot of the voices were dubbed over. Now, the one that they did, the reason they did that for Frank, like I said, was because it was two different actors playing him, so they wanted, like, the same person's voice. You know, which makes sense. But the weird thing, too, is that initially, I mean, Clive Barker is British, he's from Liverpool, and so the story was an English story. Yeah, so it was set in England. And for whatever reason, well, I know for whatever reason, but it's like the producers, New World Pictures, were like, no, we don't really want this to be British because Americans won't watch British movies or something.
Which that was a weird thing, man. They used to do that back then.
Why?
And these are old guys thinking this because I think that might have been the situation back in the 60s.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it was a little bit harder back in the 60s and 70s to sell movies. But the people who were buying these in 87 were mostly teenage guys, you know, and people renting it from Blockbuster. They didn't give a shit where the movie came from.
No, as long as it was gory or had tits.
Yeah, and it had some badass monsters in it. Matter of fact, you know, being British, it would have been a bonus. Like Rawhead Rex, we liked it because it was kind of like happening in Ireland.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were mostly, you know, Anglo-Americans, mostly kind of like Irish-Americans, you know, really, you know, if you probably did a DNA test. That's probably where it all come back from. So we all kind of had like Irish heritage in your family. So it's like, yeah, man, back in the old country.
Right, you know what I'm talking exactly.
About? Back in the old country.
That's just so weird
so
to me.
I don't know what the fuck they're talking
so
about.
So the weird thing is that, so they overdub some of the, it's weird because Claire Higgins, who plays Julia, who's, her and Pinhead are the best things about this movie. I'll say that right now. You know, and obviously Doug Bradley is British, but you know, it's like, well, we have to put an American in it. So the guy they got to play, Larry, who actually, Andrew Robinson is the actor's name. He was in fucking, God damn it. What was that Clint Eastwood movie? He played, Scorpio. He played like the villain in one of those fucking,
I don't know.
Shit, man. I can't remember the name of it right now. It's just gone right out of my head. But yeah, he was in that. Now he's an American actor. So cause they wanted an American in it. They let like the other people be British, but then they set it in some random, like they never tell you like where the setting is. It's supposed to be in the United States, but they don't really say where it is.
Yeah. Cause I was asking you where the fuck, I was like, where the fuck is this? It looked like Canada.
I'm pretty sure they shot it in the UK, but although they wanted it to look like
in the background, they showed that building, that factory. Off the damn Pink Floyd album cover. It looks like a fucking upside down fucking animal four stacks.
Yeah,
I saw that, so it must have been England somewhere.
I think they did shoot it in England. But like I kind said, of. In you know, the producers were like, well, we have to just like set it in a non-specific mid-Atlantic U.S.
Yeah, it kinda,
state or something like that. It's, it was just
worked.
Really weird. It kind of works just because, I mean, this movie didn't have like a super high budget and a lot of it takes place in one house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's not like a lot of extraneous like sets and shit like that. It's mostly just this character drama with these three main characters and this skinless dude upstairs. And, you know, a lot of it is kind of set in there. So you can tell that like most of the budget went on the costumes and the makeup and the special effects because they're still fucking amazing. Yeah. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Cenobites... I remember in the novella, because I think that Clive Barker wrote a couple other, he wrote something called like the Scarlet Gospel, I think it was called. And then there was like another, Hellraiser later on where he kind of expanded on the mythology of them a little bit. They were kind of like this, you know, this, order of demons, like in hell called the Order of the Gash or something like that. And what they're just like travelers, like I said, through, you know, they say in the movie where they're just kind of like, they no longer like can tell the difference between pleasure and pain anymore. They're not, and it's weird in the movie, they're set up as villains, but not really, because they only come when you call them.
Yeah.
And you call them because you want
this, what they have to
offer. This kind of sadomasochistic experience. It's like these people that are like going to extremes and it's like they've done everything and like they want.
Yeah, and this was a ballsy idea back
then. It was in 87,
Yeah, I remembered, you know, just how we were reacting to the concept of this, where you find this damn box, it's like a puzzle, and if you open it up, they come from another dimension and do this to you, you know, because they think you called them. And that idea back in 87 was fucking mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's like, it was a revolutionary idea.
Yeah, you'd
be
sitting there thinking about that, going, oh man, that'd be some weird shit, you know what I mean? Nowadays, you know, it doesn't seem too exciting. But
everybody's so jaded.
Everybody's jaded now, you know, the idea of other dimensions and internet. Internet blows away all this shit.
I know. It's kind of I love the internet.
Destroyed the imagination.
But it really did, because like back in 87, when you saw this, it was just kind of like, holy fucking shit. You'd never seen anything like this. And like I said,
you never thought anything like
that. And that's what I mean. That's the first time that I read Clive Barker when I was a kid, which I think was Books of Blood, Volume 1. And some of the stories that he wrote in there, I'm like, how the fuck did this dude even think of this shit? Holy crap.
Yeah, internet opened up your mind wide, opened all kinds of weird shit. You could find anything. You could just type it in a damn Google search engine back before it was fucking censored like it is now. You'd see small kinds of weird shit. And it's just, back in 87, that concept would blow your fucking mind.
Yeah. Well, and the thing too is that, I mean, when he first conceived The Hellbound Heart, and when he first conceived this movie, his idea going forward was that the main protagonist and the, you know, person that was going to carry through the series, like, you know, as it went on, was going to be Julia, because she's essentially an evil character. She's a horrible, bitchy. I mean, not only is she fucking around at her husband, But then she decides, oh, I love this dude's dick so much that I'm going to kill people so he can have his fucking skin back. Yeah. And she doesn't, like, care who she kills. So she gets kind of more and more evil as it goes on. But the interesting thing about it was that when the movie came out, and they didn't really seem to realize this before the movie came out, when the movie came out, everybody latched onto the Pinhead character. Just because, like, and the Cenobites in general, because there's, like, the Chatterer and the one that they call Butterball, like, the big fat one, and the female one with the vagina thing in her
neck. That was her throat cut up.
Yeah, her throat was cut open. Well, that's why the guy said he wanted it to look, like, vaginal.
Yeah. Her voice was coming out of there. It was weird. But I think it had a lot to do with his voice.
His voice. He has a great fucking voice.
His voice sold that character.
Oh, yeah.
And made that character into something that people wanted to see more and more of. But like I said, by the time movie 3 came around, I didn't want to see any more of it.
Yeah, it's a great concept, and it's like it needed.
The more it has diminishing returns. The more you know about them, the less mystery they have. So you're like, oh, that's all it is.
Yeah, and in general, I think that's true with any horror franchise, and I think that's why that's probably the main reason why sequels tend to get worse and worse as they go on. Is that you have something as cool as the Cenobites. And you just get little snippets. They don't really say, like, they appear every now and then, and he says, demons to some, angels to others.
Yeah.
You called us, we came.
They should never explain that.
And
they're
just like, just don't explain it. It's, you know what I mean? The more it goes on, it's not cool. But like I said, amazingly, this was Doug Bradley's first movie. Now, I was watching the Leviathan documentary earlier today, and he gave a very interesting anecdote. He said, since this was my first movie, and he knew Clive from the stage acting that they had done prior, and he said, my agent said, well, you can either have the lead Cenobite part, or you can be one of the guys that when they were moving in at the beginning, one of the guys that was helping them move the mattress up the stairs. And he said, for a few minutes, I kind of thought maybe I should be the mattress guy because
he has lines. And
because you'll be able to see my face. Oh, okay, he said, because this is my first movie and I want to be able to like point it, and I don't want to be like under all this makeup and you don't recognize me. You know what I mean? So he's like, so I did think about it for a few minutes that it's like, maybe I should be that guy. So I just look like a regular person instead of like a monster.
No, he made the right decision.
But then, other than that, and it's funny because he seems like.
He'd have been forgotten.
Yeah, he seems like a really cool guy. And like I said, he played Pinhead in like 7 or 8 of the subsequent movies.
Made a whole career
of it. And he made a whole like career of it. Yeah. But, as you said, had he not played that character with that fucking voice that he has.
Never would have.
I don't think that this movie would have been. I think it would have still been iconic because the effects are great. The idea is great. The concept. But the fact that it's still so memeable, fact that people know the puzzle box, they know Pinhead, they know lines from the movie, even if they haven't seen it in years and years.
All those sequels and it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, if it wasn't for him.
Or they would have happened, they just wouldn't have been as good.
Yeah.
Because the sequels were all built around that damn character.
Pinhead
character. And so it was carrying that whole, fucking series. But, some dudes just want to keep going down in a path and know more and more, and they get all off into it. So some people like me, knowing too much spoils it. They should have never explained those characters. I don't think they should have ever given them any backgrounds.
Yeah, it demystifies a lot. And like I said, and I've mentioned this many times before, but it's like horror, especially, is a genre that thrives on mystery and on the unknown, and the more you know about something, the less scary it is,
right? Sometimes the less interesting.
Yeah, and the less interesting, you have to have some mystery, some intrigue, some kind of thing. Like otherwise it's just gonna become boring and it's just gonna be routine and like everything else. But there's like fucking Doug Bradley has some great stories about like doing them, because obviously the makeup was like really intense, and it's like a lot of them, like, he could see mostly, but he had like this black contacts, but he could barely see, and he had like that big long leather thing, and it's like he didn't really know where he was going, he kept tripping on it and shit. But some of the other, like the other Cenobites, like the Chatterer and stuff, like he couldn't see anything.
Yeah, no eyes.
Like the guy that was in that, and the guy that played Butterball that had like the sunglasses and stuff, he couldn't really see either. So they were just kind of like having to push him into place and being like, hey, action. And you have to think that like this movie was like the first movie for a lot of these actors. They had done stage shit and, like, you know, things like that, but this was, like, their first kind of big movie. And like I said, even though it cost, like, less than $1 million, but ended up making a shit ton, and of course spawned tons and tons and tons of sequels. Now, ever since going back to, like, the mid-2000s, I believe, they've been talking about doing, of course, a remake.
That's because they can't come up with anything.
But it hasn't come to fruition, thankfully. Mostly because all of the directors that they've asked to do it are like, well, we don't want to do it exactly like the original. We just want to, like, one idea that I heard that they just wanted to, like, expand on the puzzle box, like the Lament configuration, and wanted to go in, like, a different direction. Every single director that they had attached was like, we do not want to do a teen horror movie. We do not want to do a PG-13. We want to do something more in the spirit of Clive Barker's original, and we want Clive Barker's okay on it. Otherwise, we don't want to do it. So they've gone through, like, two or three different directors, and because, of course, the producers want to make it a fucking PG-13, like they did with fucking the Friday the 13th remake, and I think the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, the Prom Night remake, all that kind of shit. They want to make the main characters teenagers and all this other kind of shit, which is just not...
Ain't gonna fly.
It's just not what the spirit of Hellraiser was. I mean, when you see the original movie, even, like, the youngest character, you know, fucking Kirsty, who's played by Ashley Lawrence... She's not a teenager. She's, like, in her 20s.
Well, these
problems, it's all adults. It's all about adults.
These problems all might be sorted out now that this fucking pandemic's happened. I mean, the big money players can't make horror movies. They just can't. Because, like you said, they want them to be PG. Because yeah, it's PG, like, it's just, they think they'll get more people in
I've
the theater.
I've seen good PG-13 horror movies. Don't get me wrong. It depends on what kind of horror movie it is. But Hellraiser... Yeah. The whole thing is about sadomasochism, eroticism, gore.
And they're focused on theaters and ticket sales. How many people can be in seats? That's already going to fuck it. You got to worry. Nowadays, it's got to be something that will it sell on streaming? Will people get it on streaming? And if it's on streaming, you want it to be R.
Yeah.
You know? Fuck the theater. That's when it comes to movies like this, I think that game's played out.
Well, and fuck remaking horror movies. I mean, I can see more along the lines of remaking something like Friday the 13th with teenage characters, because that's kind of what the original was like. But Hellraiser was essentially an adult-oriented domestic drama with sadomasochism and gore elements, and a lot of eroticism too, which was taken out. Clive Barker thought that was very funny, that he's like, there were a couple of, like, the flashback scenes, like with Frank and Julia characters. He's like, I had some really, like, really sexually, like, charged, like, kind of shit, you know, with some anal and everything. And of course, like, the MPA was like, oh no, you can't do that. But they thought, but it was fine for, like, for them to do blood, like, and, you know, when they're having sex, like him with the knife and everything.
It's
like, oh, the violence is fine. But it's like, he's like, the MPAA told him, he's like, you can have two male thrusts, but three is obscene.
That's
you
can
have two. Now, some of the gore has been taken out too. Like the very end scene where Frank, wearing Larry's skin, where he gets pulled apart by all the hooks and, like, says that great line, Jesus wept. Which was apparently that actor's ad lib.
Yeah.
He was supposed to just say, fuck you.
Yeah.
And the actor was like, nah, that seemed kind of lame. He's like, so he just said that instead. And Clive was like, oh yeah, that's awesome. So there was a longer cut of that, like when his head exploded. Some of the kill scenes where Julia is killing the random dudes, like with the hammer and stuff, that there was a lot more gore there. And they took trimmed a little bit of that out. And like I said, they took out some of the... Because I think one of those scenes, like the guy who was being murdered wanted to be naked, because he's like, well, it makes more sense because I think I'm going to get laid. And then she turns around and whacks him in the head with a hammer. So they shot it both ways. But like I said, they thought there was too much nudity in it. They thought there was too much eroticism in it. They, you know, so a lot of that got cut out.
They're pussies.
That's what I mean. So Clive was like, there was some great spanking scenes with Frank and Julian. Yeah. It's like, I don't know what happened to him.
Right.
We shot them.
What's funny is they want to make a fucking $100 million, wrap up $200 million in the production of a movie so they can make $1 billion. That's just not going to happen. And Hellraiser wasn't a success because of box office sales. I don't think it made all that much money at the box office.
Well, it did, but that's because it didn't cost that much to make.
Yeah, but what it yielded wasn't really much. It was only, you know, it made profit, but I'm saying it didn't make a whole lot of money at the theater. It made its money at the video rental store.
Yeah. Because everybody wanted to see that shit. Because, boy, that had a, like, fucking huge... I think it made 15 mil in the theaters. Like I said, it cost a little less than $1 million to make, so it made, like, way...
Yeah, 50 million is nothing.
Way times its budget back.
If you release something like that today, that's what it would make, probably, in a theater.
Yeah.
You know, you got to go for streaming. Streaming is today's version of video rental.
And that's, I always feel like, if you're going to make a horror movie... Make a fucking horror movie. Don't dick around. I don't see the point... You know, like I said, I've seen a lot of really good PG-13 horror movies. Don't get me wrong. It can be done well. But if you're going to do a slasher movie, for example, or something like Hellraiser... PG-13 ain't gonna cut it.
No.
Because the whole reason that people go see movies like that is largely for the gore and, you know, to see a lot of the practical effects. If you're just gonna cut away every time somebody gets killed, what's the fucking point of watching it?
And studios, Hollywood studios, they only make money, I mean, they only make movies to make a bunch of money on turnaround on opening night. That's all they care. Big boom on opening night. They're not patient. They don't give a shit about that fucking video sales. We don't have time for that.
Or, like, for it to build up into a cult classic or something like
Most profitable movie of all times is fucking Road Warrior. Mad Max Road Warrior.
Yeah.
And I don't think they didn't spend much money on it, but over time, it's just like hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah. That thing is made on video rentals and streamings, and it took a long time for it to reach that amount, but I think it's last I checked, it was the most profitable movie in history.
Yeah, Road and I Warrior. Feel like, you know, I know you can say it's, you know, the studios, they're just in the business to make money. So they want their, you know, they want their investment back, like, within a couple of days.
Right.
They don't really have time to, like, dick around and see, like, oh, you know, the movie comes out, nobody sees it. But then 10 years later, everybody's like, oh, it's a classic. And now it's making money because everybody wants to see it. But,
well, they're supporting all these people inside that industry and all their mansions. They got a lot of debts to pay. You know, the idea of taking $3 million, making a movie and stream it, and in four days make $10 million, and that's a shit ton of money, that's not enough for them.
Yeah.
But like I said earlier when we were doing sidetracks, it's now opened up for the little guy.
Yeah.
You know,
like, Like I said, I feel like it's been going in that direction the last 10, 20 years anyway.
We're in the punk rock phase of the movie industry.
Yeah,
it's
definitely the DIY type of...
That's right. Doing it yourself and making small productions and streaming them and making a name for yourself with a cool movie with original content, and it didn't cost much to make, and you did it your way, and fuck what the studio says, and fuck whether it's just your movie. That's really going to be the future.
And yeah, and that definitely applies to Hellraiser because Clive Barker wrote the fucking story. He's like, I want to make a movie out of it. He was able to secure, you know, maybe only $1 million or something like that. But he made a movie that people still talk about nowadays, that everybody knows who fucking Pinhead is. Like I said, even if people that aren't into horror movies, if you show them a picture of Pinhead or of the puzzle box, everybody knows what the fuck that is.
You're right. Out of $1 million movie.
Yeah, and you can't really say that about a lot of movies.
Think of all the merchandising that was sold on the back of that. Shirts and little fucking autographed pictures. And man, fucking...
Fucking Doug Bradley, his whole fucking career is just because he came out like with this... He was in the movie for maybe 10 minutes. Came out in that fucking makeup and that fucking voice. And that was it. Like, you know, that was just kind of like... And like I said, he wasn't even supposed to be the main thrust of that movie. They were just kind of supposed to kind of be in the background type of thing. Yeah. They weren't supposed to be the main characters. Julia was supposed to be the main character. She was in the second movie. You know, she got brought back because she died at the end of the first one. But you know, they can bring you back with the blood and everything.
And the horror scene is like a culty to begin with.
Yeah.
You put out a good horror movie... If you're an actor, you'll be able to do fucking conventions for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and we've mentioned that.
Like the woman who played Jason's mom. She did all these classy flicks. When she got older, they were all forgotten. But what was remembered was her being Jason's mom.
Well, Voorhees.
Was her whole fucking job, is to be an old lady in that damn sweater and signing autographs and entertaining at the damn. And she had a life.
Yeah.
She was making money off of that.
Yeah.
You know, and being able to pay bills. All those big high-class movies that she had made. What was her name again? Betsy Palmer.
Yeah.
She made a bunch of high-class movies in the 60s and shit. Those were all long forgotten, and they stopped paying the bills.
Well, yeah.
Horror is really where it's at in terms of, it's like a cult.
And, like I said, and I...
Dollar for dollar, that's where it's
and
at.
And I'm glad that, like, kind of, you know, the stigma about horror isn't really around anymore like it was back in the old days. And it's funny that you mentioned her thing, because Andrew Robinson, the guy that plays Larry in Hellraiser, he said a very similar thing in the Leviathan documentary. He said, you know, when I was in this movie, he's like, I'd done Shakespeare and all this other stuff. He's like, my daughter... She was like, fuck that. And she didn't care about the movie. She's like, he's like, but when I was in Hellraiser, I was like, cool, dad.
Right.
Suddenly. Cause it's like all her and all her friends wanted to see that shit.
Yeah. Just the other day, we saw a really cool, you know, Krussel movie called, what was it? Breakdown?
Breakdown. Yeah.
And Breakdown was a fucking great movie, kind of like The Hitcher or
Duel. Yeah.
Duel, but it's forgotten.
Yeah. Even though it was really successful at the time.
It was real successful at the time. They made money on it, but it was like a flash in the pan. It's forgotten. Had that been a horror equivalent movie, Krussel would still be going to the damn horror conventions, you know,
probably.
What I mean? And fucking signing all kinds of autographs and shit.
Like I said, if you want to like make a shit ton of money, then
maybe
don't do horror movies. But if you want to be an actor and you want to be remembered forever and adored forever, do horror or sci-fi.
Yeah.
And you will have a fucking career forever out of that shit.
The only obstacle in horror movies is the writing. It's got to be a badass story with some new ideas in it. And that's kind of hard. So you'd have to go back to like tried and true methods. You know what I mean? And good writing and good characters and a good monster and a good twist on something with a good score. And you just try to make it a classic.
Yeah.
You know?
I like, you know what? It's now that you mentioned score, it's actually, I'm glad you mentioned that because I wanted to mention this. the score for Hellraiser was actually done by Christopher Young, who I think had done Freddy's Dead, the second Nightmare on Elm Street. But originally, Clive Barker wanted the band Coil to do the music for Hellraiser.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which would have been cool. Awesome.
It'd been really cool.
Because I love fucking Coil.
It fell through for some reason.
It did. Well, they had a meeting, them and Christopher Young, and they kind of had a thing. And I think Christopher Young actually ended up using some of their ideas, like, and acknowledging that.
Yeah.
But, there was some kind of thing they couldn't come to an agreement or whatever. Because Clive Barker was friends with them.
Yeah.
And he was really, like, a big fan of their work and stuff. So he wanted them to score the movie, but for whatever reason, it didn't work out. Which... Like I said, I like Christopher Young's score for this, but it's kind of a shame because I really, really like Coil.
Would have put a whole new spin on it.
And I would have, and I would have liked to have heard what they could do, like, with this type of movie. Because this is very much in line with
been real industrial.
With that type of, like, the shit that was going on at the time.
It would have been like a prototype of a Nine Inch Nails video.
It would have been. It probably would have looked exactly like that. Yeah. But yeah, so I encourage you, if you have not seen Hellraiser for a very long time, or if you've never seen it, because like I said, we have some younger people and... Maybe you haven't seen it because it came out so long ago, back in 1987.
Yeah.
Then definitely check it out. It's a classic. Like I said, the second one, I remember the second one being really good. I saw that several times. I haven't seen it for several years, but I saw it on cable like a lot back in the old days. I saw the third one, but I don't remember anything about it. And I don't think that I saw any of the other ones subsequently. And I heard that they went downhill. Like I said, I don't usually hang in there. Other than we watched all the Phantasm movies, and those are all
stronger.
Those are all pretty entertaining. I thought
Phantasm is the only horror,
oddly
is the only horror series that I've ever seen that actually got stronger as it went.
And that they had so many movies that were consistently decent. Like every single one of them was decent.
It was same guy making them.
Yeah,
they were handcrafted. He cared about it, and he kept upping the ante and upping the ante and doing it his way. And really, the worst one was the one that had a real studio behind it. And it wasn't that bad. I think it was
The part two. I like that one, though.
It's pretty
good.
That
was the first one that I saw.
Yeah,
I saw that
good.
In the theater.
But the ones that he made, I think, were better. There were a lot more purity in them, I think.
Well, you can go weirder.
You got weirder, right.
And weirder is usually better.
Yeah, it went, you know, at the end, it's like Mad Max, End of the World, him against the demons and shit.
And gotta love Reggie.
Yeah, demons, Reggie, and demons from another dimension.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
I know.
I want to see that one again.
I know. I think Shudder has 3, 4, and 5.
Okay.
And maybe the first one. I don't really remember. Now, Shudder, like I said, it has the first Hellraiser and the second Hellraiser. And it also has that 2-part documentary called Leviathan. It's very long. I think it's about 3 hours. Like the first part's 1.5 hours and just talks about Hellraiser. Then the second part talks about Hellbound. And that's, another 1.5 hours.
You inspired me. Not only do I want a fucking Neville action figure. I want an action.
You want a Reggie Bannister?
I want a Reggie action figure
with his ice with an ice cream truck.
Ice cream truck.
I bet you could buy one.
No, I want him. I want him like the final Reggie.
Yeah, like from Ravager or whatever.
From Ravager, right? One where he's almost going Mad Max. It'd be pretty cool.
He's such a great fucking character. Yeah. It's like the most horror hero ever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I imagine I'll have to look. Somebody must be making one.
Yeah, that I would think that somebody was. It might be like, I'm sure it's limited edition.
You're right.
But every other fucking character has been covered. So I would be surprised.
I like some of those customs guys are making. I think they're like a 12-inch doll. The fucking outfits like a G.I. Joe and everything. And, you know, they're doing, you know, fucking Snake Plissken, and they're doing Neville from a Mega Man. And I'd like to have a Reggie like that. So it's like a G.I. Joe doll.
Yeah.
It'd be awesome. With the guns and everything.
That would be pretty cool.
Yeah. They're making them. It's just like, I think they're made on like kind of like standardized bodies.
We can buy
bodies,
like a generic doll.
Genetic body. Yeah. And then you can buy, people are fucking handcrafting
heads. Sculpting the heads. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to put on there.
That way you're not violating, or maybe you are violating copyrights, but no, I don't think so. You're assembling it yourself.
Yeah. I've always kind of wondered about what the legality of that is, because you
got a doll's head. That has fucking, you know what I mean, Krussel's face on it.
Yeah.
You know? I guess it's just bootleg. People making them.
It's got to be, because, I mean, actors, as far as I know, particularly one of, like, you know, high caliber of Kurt Russell.
You're not supposed to be able to get their
image. Yeah, like, you can't use their image on things. Like,
but evidently, people are breaking those rules in that action figure, custom action figure.
Maybe if you make it like look 30% like someone other than Kurt Russell, you can get away with it.
I don't know. Well, a lot of the shit that it's made out of is just a standard body.
Yeah, and there's a lot standard
of the costumes
doll body.
The costumes are made out of just replicas of shit that they bought out of the store anyway. Yeah. You know what I mean? When they made the movie. Like the Terminator costume, you could buy that back then in those days. That was just a jacket and the right pants.
My dad
right
had those boots.
Well, you can buy those boots for action figures.
Yeah.
So that's just because you put it together to look like the Terminator, that doesn't mean you did that. You're not selling it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And each component was bought separately.
Yeah. I mean, so, I think you would get in trouble if you were like selling it or like making a profit off it.
Yeah.
You could probably get away with it if you sold it for exactly what you spent making it.
Or if it's a one of a kind creation. Because
you're not profiting. Yeah.
And it's not in a package. It's not in a box. You don't
It's weird because I see a lot of horror stuff and it's like, I always wonder.
Like, is that violating copyright? Yeah.
Maybe there's so much of it that they just can't.
Can't control it, maybe.
Control it or keep up with it.
I don't know.
I don't know. But yeah. So anyway, if you haven't seen it, like I said, both the first two are on Shudder, as is the 3-hour-long documentary. Thanks again to Dominic for sending me the really nice special edition Blu-ray. I'm watching all the extra shit on there. As we speak, but you know, over the last few days, I've been watching all the extra shit on there. So yeah, check it out.